So I think last time we finished the previous chapter, chapter 5, which was the chapter on the cosmic illusion. Mind, dream, and hallucination. And now we'll move on to chapter 6. But in the cosmic illusion, mind, dream, and hallucination, he begins to look at this view that we live in an illusion, which has been called the Mayavadin view, popular in India through Buddhism as well as through Shankara's Advaita Vedanta, and also present in some other schools in various degrees and forms, as for example in Taoism to some extent. And so we find that this notion of either life existence as we experience it being a dream or being unreal, and therefore something that is imposed in place of something which is real, that seems to have reality, hallucination. These are the arguments he takes up through this chapter. And then he looks also at mind as a creator of these kinds of effects. So, to the argument of dream and hallucination, he questions the rightness of the analogy. And he tries to show that in both cases, what is actually being experienced has its basis in actuality. And in the case of the mind creating imaginary projects, he shows that these are also based on a synthesizing faculty working out of realities and actualities. So it is by these means that he presents a kind of agnostic doubt on the ideas of the Mayavada school in terms of their analogies. These analogies don't hold. But as he'll say at the beginning of the next chapter, that doesn't either prove or disprove the stance of whether this experience is a reality or an illusion. And so he'll probe it philosophically. One may say that through this entire chapter, he has probed it psychologically. And he will probe it philosophically in the next chapter. So we can round up by looking at the last paragraph in this previous chapter, which we have finished, where he sums up the conclusion of this chapter. This then is the dual possibility that arises before us. So there are two possibilities that, are what this chapter concludes with. There is, we may suppose, an original consciousness and power, creative of illusions and unrealities, with mind as its instrument or medium in the human and animal consciousness, so that the differentiated universe we see is unreal, a fiction of Maya, and only some indeterminable and undifferentiated absolute is real. So this is the first of the two possibilities that he considers, which is that there is some kind of consciousness. See, this consciousness creates illusion, so it is a subjective expression arising out of this consciousness, and we don't know what the ground of this is. In other words, is there a ground to it at all which lends its substance and its being to the formulations of this consciousness, or is it without any ground? this question is something he'll raise in the next paragraph. But just judging that by this proposition, there is some kind of a expression from this consciousness. But to make itself valid, it has to act subjectively inside the creature to whom the illusions will be presented. And therefore, it acts through the mind. And that's what the first premise is saying. An original consciousness and power, creative of illusions and unrealities, with mind as its instrument or medium. And then we go on to the second one. Or there is, we may equally suppose, an original, a supreme or cosmic truth consciousness, creative of a true universe, but with mind acting in that universe as an imperfect consciousness, ignorant, partly knowing, partly not knowing, a consciousness which is, by its ignorance or limitation of knowledge, capable of error, misrepresentation, mistaken or misdirected development from the known, of uncertain gropings towards the unknown, of partial creations and buildings, a constant half position between truth and error, knowledge and nescience. So this is the second possibility, that there is a truth consciousness that is creating a true cosmos, but that our perception of the cosmos is mental perception, and mind itself is a ignorant formation or ignorant operation of this same consciousness. And therefore, its perceptions are problematic, but the originator of the perceptions is true. But this ignorance, in fact, proceeds, however stumblingly, upon knowledge and towards knowledge. It is inherently capable of shedding the limitation, the mixture, and can turn by that liberation into the truth consciousness, into a power of the original knowledge. Our inquiry has so far led rather in the second direction. So he points out how up to this point his argument has shown the greater plausibility of this second interpretation. It points towards the conclusion that the nature of our consciousness is not of a character that would justify the hypothesis of a cosmic illusion as the solution of its problem. A problem exists, but it consists in the mixture of knowledge with ignorance in our condition, in our cognition of self and things. And it is the origin of this imperfection that we have to discover. So where does this cognition, cognitive imperfection originate? There is no need of bringing in an original power of illusion, always mysteriously existent in the eternal reality, or else intervening and imposing a world of non-existent forms on a consciousness or superconscious that is forever pure, eternal, and absolute. So here is where he imposes his radical doubt on this entire premise of a unreal existence or unreal manifestation that is generated by power of illusion, an illusory power or maya. Now, one thing to note is that he'll go back to consider these topics in the next paragraph in much greater philosophical detail. And you know, we noted how in Sri Aurobindo's method, even in his poetic text like Savitri, he proceeds through a build-up of a certain argument and then ends sometimes with a leap which opens a new horizon. And this is how he ends this paragraph. But often that leap is taken along with a certain kind of a doubt, an inconclusion, which he will take up further later. And this is exactly what happens here. So he goes back to the entire argument in the next chapter, Reality and the Cosmic Illusion. So with that, we can begin this chapter. Unless there are some comments or questions on the previous chapter that anybody would like to make.
Margaret, would you like to start reading?
Yes. Chapter 6, Reality and the Cosmic Illusion. The eternal is true. The world is alive. Vivekachudamani. 1. Verse 20. The master of Maya creates this world by his Maya, and within it is confined another. One should know his Maya as nature, and the master of Maya as the great Lord of all. Swita Swatara Upanishad 2, Chapter 4, 9, 10. The Purusha is all this that is, what has been and what is yet to be. He is the master of immortality, and he is whatever grows by food. Rig Veda. 3, 4, Chapter 1092, Sweta Swatara Upanishad 4, Chapter 3, 15. All is the Divine Being, Gita, footnote 5, Chapter 7, 19. But so far, we have only cleared a part of the foreground of the field of inquiry. In the background, the problem remains unsolved and entire. It is the problem of the nature of the original consciousness or power that has created or conceptively constructed or manifested the universe and the relation to it of our world cognition. In sum, whether the universe is a figment of consciousness imposed on our mind by a supreme force of illusion, or a true formation of being experienced by us with a still ignorant but an increasing knowledge. And the true question is not of mind alone, or of a cosmic dream or a cosmic hallucination born of mind, but of the nature of the reality, the validity of the creative action that takes place in it or is imposed upon it, the presence or absence of a real content in its or our consciousness and its or our regard on the universe. On behalf of illusionism, it can be answered to the position put forward by us with regard to the truth of existence, that all this might be valid within the bounds of the cosmic illusion. It is the system, the pragmatic machinery by which Maya works and maintains herself in the ignorance. But the truths, possibilities, actualities of the cosmic system are true and actual only within the illusion. Outside that magic circle, they have no validity. They are not abiding and eternal realities. All are temporary figures, the works of knowledge, no less than the works of ignorance. It can be conceded that knowledge is a useful instrument of the illusion of mind, for escaping from herself, for destroying herself in the mind. Spiritual knowledge is indispensable, but the one true truth, the only abiding reality beyond all duality of knowledge and ignorance, is the eternal, relationless, absolute, or the self, the eternal, pure existence. All here turns on the mind's conception and the mental being's experience of reality. For according to the mind's experience or conception of reality will be its interpretation of data, otherwise identical. The facts of the cosmos, individual experience, the realization of the supreme transcendence, all mental cognition depends on three elements: the percipient, the perception, and the thing perceived or percept. All or any of these three can be affirmed or denied reality. The question then is which of these, if any, are real and to what extent or in what manner. If all three are rejected as instruments of a cosmic illusion, the farther and consequent question arises, is there then a reality outside them? And if so, what is the relation between the reality and the illusion?
So Sri Aurobindo starts this chapter with these quotations, as he always does. And the first of those quotations is actually the illusionistic premise stated in a most succinct nutshell. It's interesting that if you look at those quotations, the first and the last are like bracket marks that state in the most succinct fashion the two premises that we are considering here. The first one is taken from Shankara's Viveka Chudamani, that has been translated as the crest jewel of discrimination. And the statement is very succinct. It is Brahma Satya Jagan Mithya, which means Brahman, the eternal is true, the world is a lie. It's just as simple as that. And the last one is taken from the Gita, and it is even simpler. All is the divine being. So these two positions, as it were, are what we are oscillating between. And then he interposes two quotations from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, an early Upanishad, which Sri Aurobindo has translated. One of the Upanishads that he gave some attention to, the first one is, the master of Maya creates this world by his Maya, and within it is confined another. One should know his Maya as nature and the master of Maya as the great lord of all. So this master of Maya creates this world by his Maya. So the master creates this world, and within it is confined another. So in other words, there is a second world confined within this world. There is a division within the creation. You know, this is an enigmatic way of talking about the knowledge and the ignorance. The master of Maya creates a world in which he is self-conscious, and he also confines another world in which he appears not to be conscious. So this is the second world within the world. One should know his Maya as nature and the master of Maya as the great lord of all. In other words, this nature force that is at work in the cosmos is the power, whether here nature is considered to be Maya, and outside of it, Brahman is considered to be as the lord of Maya. or a nature as Maya is something which is separate from the Lord. These two possibilities are resolved here in saying that you have to realize that even if it appears to be ignorant, still the master of this nature is the great Lord of all. So there is a backgrounding, pure existence, you may say, that Brahman. And then the last one, or the third one, is again from the same Upanishad, and it posits the Purusha. Actually, the Svetashvatara Upanishad is, in a sense, a Shaivite Upanishad. It's the first one that explicitly mentions Shiva as the origin of the entire or reality, Brahman as Shiva. And so he is also equated to Purusha. So the Purusha is all this that is, what has been and what is yet to be. He is the master of immortality, and he is whatever grows by food. In other words, the transcendent and the immanent, the eternal and the transient, or the that which is within time, the temporal. So this is how he kind of prefaces the discussion. And then in this first paragraph, he follows up from before, but he is here saying what is really the question that we have to consider. It is not merely a question about whether this is a certain illusion that is imposed on the mind by a supreme force of illusion, or a true formation of being experienced by us with a still ignorant but increasing knowledge. Remember, these are the two positions that he ends the previous chapter with. But he goes behind these to ask the question about what is the ground of reality. The true question is not of mind alone, or of a cosmic dream or cosmic hallucination born of mind, but of the nature of the reality, the validity of the creative action that takes place in it or is imposed upon it. What is the ground and what is the relation with that ground of this experiencing faculty that brings us into confrontation with the world? The presence or absence of a real content in its or our consciousness and its or our regard on the universe. So the relation is actually going to determine what is the nature of the universe, because depending on what is the relation between reality and what seems to be unreal, we can come to some understanding of what is the status of that which seems to be unreal. And then he takes up the illusionistic argument once more, and he looks upon it as saying, in response to his view, that all this may be true, but it is only true within a great subjective illusion. In other words, there is a cosmic illusion, and within the cosmic illusion, there is some kind of power of intelligence at work that seems to give this sense of reality to things. But this entire structure or creation seems to be meaningful, yet is not really true, is real, unreal. And behind it, there is nothing. This is how he looks at the illusionistic school. Not that there is nothing, but there is a gulf between this subjective projection of Maya and the immutable, that which does not brook any change, that which does not brook any experience other than its own eternal status of being, of pure being. So that's how he presents the illusionistic argument against, as it were, his own theory. And then he ends with talking about what can be unreal. He is analyzing perception into its constituents, three constituents, the percipient, the perception, and the thing perceived, or the percept. And here he's saying that all or any of these three can be affirmed or denied reality. The question then is, which of these, if any, are real? And to what extent and in what manner? If all three are rejected as instruments of a cosmic illusion, the further and consequent question arises, is there then a reality outside them? And if so, what is the relation between the reality and the illusion? This is the question of this entire chapter. And this relation is what he foregrounds as the object of his consideration. It may also be noted that in proceeding with this paragraph, he raises the question of knowledge. What is the place of knowledge? If all this is an illusion, what are we trying to do in even trying to understand? Why do we have a faculty of knowing? And this is a question which Shankara raises himself. Because in a certain way, this way of proceeding is the foundation of what is called Jnana Yoga, or the Yoga of Knowledge. The Yoga of Knowledge proceeds by Viveka. That's why that great the book that he quotes from, Viveka Chudamani, the crest jewel of discrimination. So the discrimination lies in using our faculties of knowledge to try and distinguish between the true and the untrue. So he's saying, if we start with the premise that this entire existence that we experience is an illusion, then what remains is that we have to use our intelligence and our discrimination to sift out the unreality from the reality. And the reality is outside of all this. And hence, the power of knowledge lies in our being able to convince ourselves that whatever we experience is not true. In other words, if the mind can argue itself into that position, then we can convince ourselves of that. That's the point he's making. It can be conceded that knowledge is a useful instrument of the illusion of Maya for escaping from herself, for destroying herself in the mind. Spiritual knowledge is indispensable, but the one true truth, the only abiding reality beyond all duality of knowledge and ignorance, is the eternal relationless absolute of the self, the eternal pure existence. In other words, Maya has introduced an escape valve in her operations, which is the human mind, so that it may use its self-knowledge of itself as illusion to escape out of its own creation. So that is the argument of Jnana Yoga in the Advaita Vedanta schools. And of course he questions that, and we may say that that kind of a view, it's a very interesting view. It proceeds on that basis also, that we are what we believe we are. You are what your faith is, as the Gita says. and the Upanishadic idea that reality is experienced through meditation on an idea. So if we start with the idea of that, what they call the Mahavakya, the succinct statement, the eternal is true, the world is a lie, we'll arrive at that very experience, that the eternal is true and the world is a lie. We put all our mental, logical faculties behind that truth, so that we meditate on that idea exclusively, and we see everything from that view. We try to impose that view on all our sensory instruments, and we'll arrive at that experience. And similarly, the last Mahavakya from the Gita, all is the divine being. If we practice that, if we convince ourselves of that, then we can practice that, we can impose that on our instruments, we'll arrive at that experience. So this is a very interesting point. That's the whole centerpiece of the epistemology of Sri Aurobindo. What is the whole rationale of writing this big book, which he sometimes called a fat elephant, is really that in understanding something, in being mentally convinced of something, we develop a force of faith which we can actually use as a power of meditation, and that can bring us experience. So illusionism has its own way of looking at that, and that's what he points out here.
It's interesting. I was just about to ask that question, that this kind of idea that the world could be an illusion, from which plane of mind, according to the Aurobindo's description of gradations of mind, from which plane of that this kind of idea comes?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. The answer is overmind. It comes from the overmind. And Sri Aurobindo makes that quite clear in Savitri, because we see that it is at the summit of overmind that this particular view imposes itself on Ashwapati. And he is struck by the biggest doubt of his entire, because there is a gulf between the entire creation and that the lid of the Maya, or the gulf between the cosmic creation and the supermind, is something which brings this view into existence from the heights of the overmind. And so that gulf has to be crossed. And only in crossing that gulf is this particular view of the alternative view made absolutely real, that it is a power of reality. And in Savitri, that gulf cannot be crossed by the human except by the grace of what is beyond, that reveals itself in that moment of extreme doubt.
So you're saying that, overmind, of course, is a very high stage. Even at the level of intuition, it's possible to get such an intuition that the world could be an illusion.
In the case of, in Savitri's case, what is interesting is that possibility does not occur until the overmind. For the protagonist, for Ashwapati, the creation is a relative, all truths are relative within the ignorance. The ignorance is a status of being in which truth is given a relative existence. So all truths are equally relative. And hence, at any point, this may impose itself as a coherent explanation, except that it's not coherent enough. And that's the point that he's trying to. He's trying to say that if we use our mental faculty, if we use our own analysis Jnana Yoga analysis, the plausibility of this viewpoint appears to be less than what it is made out to be by these schools. But from an experiential point of view, it may impose itself at any point, as it were.
I mean, what I was trying to understand probably is that because for us, usually our highest, I mean, the access, the highest plane of mind that we have usually access to once in a while by grace is the intuition, right? Intuitive plane. And that seems somehow this kind of idea that the world is an illusion somehow kind of hits that point. I mean, that no, it can't be, you know, like something refuses to accept that. And of course, that is not possible to prove it either, right? That the world is an illusion. It is ultimately an abstract idea.
Yeah, right. It is an abstract idea. One may say that it's a vast world pessimism. And this world pessimism may arise out of certain conditions. It may also have a historical origin in the fact that early stages or stages of human existence, which were full of hardship, have yielded this particular view to answer the question, why is there so much suffering and hardship in the world? This has been, in fact, the Buddhist view presents itself in these terms, that it is out of suffering that we have to emerge. So it may be that that becomes, that truth of experience becomes the basis of this, you know, of this kind of thing, of intuiting this kind of idea. Because ultimately, you are right, it is something that some part of our own intuition feels to be untrue. But that may only be because we have been exposed to other ways of thinking and to an early humanity which was much more subject to suffering. It was more easy to convince that this is a world which is illusory. If God exists, he couldn't have created such a world. And if God doesn't exist, of course, there is no question. But God does exist if we look at our scriptures and all that, but he must be outside of all this completely. And this must be an illusion that has somehow generated itself in his being.
I mean, yeah. Well, basically, the first quality of this kind of ideas that strikes me is the abstractness and also kind of a rational impulse, I mean, you know, compulsion that you have to decide or kind of propose an idea. So this abstraction and this kind of conclusive, rationally conclusiveness, these two are kind of, preventing me from thinking that it could be anything above the rational mind plane.
You know, this may also be a result of what you're saying, the idea of the abstractness of this this notion is also something that may be a result of our times, because we take the world to be real. That is the founding faith of materialism. Even if we, think that there is a divine in it, even if it, one might say it's a divine materialism, which is sort of what Sri Aurobindo and the mother are saying, still, that the world is real is something which is intrinsic to us as modern humans. But this is not necessarily the case earlier in pre-modern times. And so what we are calling real and abstract in our instinctive understanding may not have been the same. The structures of consciousness were different at that time. And it was much more easy for somebody to look at the world in as if it had only reality in their minds. The so-called reality of the world is something that presents itself with a much stronger force to us today, because we are born into a world where everybody believes that. But that may not be the case to all times and all places.
Beautiful. Thank you. That explains it to me. Basically, that means that there is some kind of evolution that has taken place in the cosmic mind or the mind of the cosmos or whatever, which is always influencing our experience and thoughts. Where some change has taken place, which is why I can't think like that.
Yeah, quite true. Certainly there's been changes of that kind, but it's interesting how long-lasting and persistent some of these ideas can be, that they might have imposed themselves with a greater instinctive reality at a certain point of history, but they continue to have a force even to this day. Though if we really look at the people who vouch for these things, we find that either they don't really experience it as such in their daily reality, or that they have modified it. For example, modern forms of Buddhism are much more world-affirming, and this entire view of the cosmic illusion has been backgrounded or spoken of in other and new ways within these schools. They seem to want to modify this premise without really changing it, you know, without really supplanting it with another idea.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't remember reading Sri Aurobindo calling the life divine a fat elephant, Devashish. Do you remember where you saw that?
Yeah, in his talks, he jokes about it.
Evening talks?
Yeah, somewhere in his evening talks, he jokes about it. He calls it in one place a fat elephant, and at one place, something like a brick or something like that, a fat brick or something like that.
That's great.
Devashish, it's interesting to me that you brought up the kind of a change in worldview of Buddhist schools, because I've noticed that kind of backgrounding when I read in The Light Divine, for example, Sri Aurobindo's comments about Buddhism, they seem like they're different, or they're referring to something that's different than what I get from, you know, listening to the Dalai Lama or something like that. I wonder if you would, can you elaborate on that change a little bit more?
Yes, John Robert. Yes, completely. I absolutely agree with what you're saying. And it's exactly that Buddhism today, particularly Buddhism as it is practiced in the West, which is very largely influenced by first the wave of Zen Buddhism that came through people like D.T. Suzuki, and later by the wave of Tibetan Buddhism in a much more ecumenical form, as has come in through the Dalai Lama, are much more life-affirming. They don't take a stand about reality as being illusory, but more about a process of purification or an erasure of ignorance that allows us to be detached and free from the conditionings of the world. That becomes its primary objective. One might call it a psychological objective rather than a meditation on the fact that the world is illusory and we must get out of it to something which is real, which has been some of the, you know, I mean, even in cases of Theravada practice, as in Vipassana, the goal is not given as one which is meant to take one out of the world, but to give one experiences of freedom through which one can return and be effective in the world. So an underlying premise of life affirmation has entered into Buddhism, I would say. This idea of the cosmic illusion has become secondary to it in our times.
So would you say that the emphasis has gone from a kind of a metaphysical emphasis on what's real to a psychological approach as to what's possible for a human experience?
Yes, exactly. And I think when you mentioned the Dalai Lama is a very good example of this. You know, he takes it the furthest. I mean, he questions premises and leaves them open, completely open. I've heard him in a kind of a close gathering, in fact, asking the question as to whether there is any consensus among Buddhists about what is Buddhism, and answering his own question after some, you know, views were put up, by saying no, that there isn't, to everything that was said, including the idea of anatman, etc. He said that there are Buddhists that he has met that don't agree with those views, and his eventual conclusion was, in a way, we are very similar to the scientists. We are ignorant people groping for knowledge, and once we recognize that, we can be a little more friendly towards each other. This is how he put it. You know.
Interesting. Thank you.
Debashish, I appreciate your putting that first line, that first quote, "The eternal is true, the world is a lie," in historical context. And I was raised in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and I've been reflecting on how monotheism had a kind of a similar feel to that line. And there was something arising, a new form of consciousness or something, that had to do, I think, with unity. And I think that at that time, there was so much an awareness or an imaginal connection with beings, multiple beings, and maybe even forms of consciousness, and they were at war and conflicting, and then all of a sudden there arises this sense of this overarching unity. And I think I'm realizing that it was so powerful, and it was something almost volcanic in human consciousness. And it overshadowed everything for a while. So I see, and I think now, there is a change in thought, recent, even within Christianity, again, this move away from this, let's say, focus on the transcendent to the fact that the divine entered into matter, like with Teilhard de Chardin and another American thinker, priest, Thomas Berry, this return to an inclusion of earth, of matter, etc. And this whole way of seeing it as divine, moving towards that last
quote, all is the divine being. But I see this as not just with regard to the East, but also with regard to the Mideast and the Western traditions.
Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's because of the explicit dualism of that view. You know, that it's interesting that it's so paradoxical that that statement states in such a trenchant way the dualism between the eternal and the world, when this whole text is supposed to be a monistic text, that there is only one. It's like saying there is only one, but we can only say there is only one by claiming that what is not one is an illusion, see, and the whole world is an illusion. So this is the kind of premise, and where it's similar to Christianity is or the entire Judeo-Christian tradition is that there too there is the idea of the duality of the creator and the created, or the creator and the creation. So that unbridgeable duality presents itself as something which keeps us in our condition of darkness and ignorance forever. And it belongs to an older world, one may say. It belongs to an older view of things. Now, there was an even earlier view of things, which was more monistic, not monotheistic, but monistic in the sense that all is the one. But this splits off in a later stage into these more dualistic ways of thinking. And it's only now that we are returning to this kind of a return of unity, as you pointed out. I think in the West, begins with the transcendentalism. First through German transcendentalism, which interestingly arises through a very strong infusion of access to Vedantic knowledge. In Indian knowledge. And then it moves into America through American transcendentalism, and then later through some of the figures that you're talking about. Thomas Berry, in fact, was very well conversant with Sri Aurobindo and used to quote him often in his conversations, etc. You mentioned Teilhard de Chardin. And there's also, people like Thomas Merton who have helped to, create a new kind of approach to Christianity that is either more psychological or more unitary, what they call panentheistic, affirms the transcendent and the immanent existence of the divine.
Thank you, Debashish. I didn't realize Thomas Berry had that connection with Sri Aurobindo.
Yeah, he did.
Owen, would you like to read next?
Yes, I can you hear me?
Yes.
I want to say something really quick about
about
this point. I've contemplated this point for practically my whole adult life, and it's been a challenge for me to bridge dualism and non-dualism and Advaita Vedanta and the kind of neo-Advaita Vedanta and whatnot, but my perspective is that everything is God, everything is energy, And like quantum physics takes us to that point that everything is in motion, everything is moving, or, you know, even thoughts and feelings come from energy. But I've kind of looked at it from the sense of free will and how we qualify those thoughts, how we qualify those feelings, or what we create physically can either be expressions of the divine or distortions. So I think it's still tough for me to wrap my head around this, but I just wanted to kind of put that out there, because the other thing too is that looking at the eternal is true and the world is a lie, sometimes this can cause me in the past to devalue my physical experience here and to devalue my incarnation into the world and to place so much emphasis on God and on also on the divine within myself, that it caused me in a way to devalue the earth plane, incarnation, and my presence here. So I wanted to put that out there, and some people have identified this as kind of a form of spiritual bypassing where you focus so much on the spirit that the incarnation into the world and the practical existence here, even of the body, neglecting the body. So bridging this dualism for me has been about recognizing that the body and my physical existence and my incarnation here is a part of that divine experience. And I think you see what I'm saying here. But I just wanted to put that out there. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Devashish.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, that's exactly what Sri Aurobindo is saying, what you're trying to say, that there is a kind of a divine substratum to everything. That divine substratum is also a consciousness, which is also an energy that has become everything that there is, and that within it, it evolves as a kind of a consciousness, as forms of consciousness that can create errors in understanding, but that doesn't mean that the creation is an illusion, and that we evolve through that process to the oneness of all things and the truth. The view that he is presenting from Viveka Chudamani is not a view that he holds. You understand that, right? He's
yes.
Presenting that view as a view that certain pervasive schools hold. And you have to also realize that to those schools, there are some premises or assumptions. And the primary assumption is, as the Buddha said, all life is suffering. And if also along with it goes the premise that the body is transient, you know, in a sense, out of dust it comes, to dust it returns. And so if that is the case, then this particular statement belongs to a social milieu in which you are being asked to leave the world. It is a kind of a sannyasa, premise. And those who follow that inevitably guided to go into monasteries and look to the experience of the spirit as the sole experience, and consciousness merging with that and devaluing earthly life, etc. They don't make any bones about it. It's not that they don't know that or that they're uncomfortable with that. They're very comfortable with that. That's what it's all about. But these questions about, you know, devaluing life, devaluing the body, etc., are part of our modern consciousness. They arise because we've already assumed a certain kind of world in which we are here to better our life conditions. See, that is part of the premise of the modern enlightenment. It's not a it's not necessarily a spiritual premise, but it's certainly a kind of a premise that we all buy into with our mother's milk. It's instinctive to us. And so what you're talking about is very natural to our times, which is why the discomfort arises. It was less of a discomfort at earlier periods of human history.
Thank you. Okay. I will start here at It Is Possible. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you. It is possible to affirm the reality of the percept of the objective universe and deny or diminish the reality of the percipient individual and his perceptive consciousness. In the theory of the sole reality of matter, consciousness is only an operation of matter energy in matter, a secretion or vibration of the brain cells, a physical reception of images and a brain response, a reflex action or a reaction of matter to the contacts of matter. Even if the rigidity of this affirmation is relaxed and consciousness otherwise accounted for, still it is no more than a temporary and derivative phenomenon, not the enduring reality. The percipient individual is himself only a body and brain capable of the mechanical reactions we generalize under the name of consciousness. The individual has only a relative value and a temporary reality. But if matter turns out to be itself unreal or derivative and simply a phenomenon of energy, as seems now to be the probability, then energy remains as the sole reality. The percipient, his perception, the perceived object, are only phenomena of energy. But an energy without a being or existence possessing it or a consciousness supplying it, an energy working originally in the void for the material field in which we see it at work in itself a creation, looks itself very much like a mental construction, an unreality. Or it might be a temporary, inexplicable outbreak of motion which might cease at any time to create phenomena. The void of the infinite alone would be enduring and real. The Buddhist theory of the percipient and the perception and the percept as a construction of karma, the process of some cosmic fact of action, gave room to such a conclusion. For it led logically to the affirmation of the non-being, void, or nil. It is possible indeed that what is at work is not an energy, but a consciousness. As matter reduces itself to energy seizable by us, not in itself, but in its results and workings, so energy could be reduced to action of a consciousness, seizable by us not in itself, but in its results and workings. But if this consciousness is supposed to work similarly in a void, we are exposed to the same conclusion, that it is a creator of temporary phenomenal illusions and itself illusory, void and infinite zero. An original non-existence is alone the enduring reality. But these conclusions are not binding. For behind this consciousness, seizable in its works, only there may be an individual original existence. A conscious energy of that existence could then be a reality. Its creations too, made out of an infinitesimal substance of being impalpable to the senses, but revealed to them at a certain stage of the action of energy as matter, would be real, as also the individual emerging as a conscious being of the original existence in a world of matter. This original reality might be a cosmic spiritual existence, a pantheos, or it might have some other status. But in any case, there would be not a universal illusion or mere phenomenon, but a true universe. Read one more, or
is that good? No, I think we'll stop and consider this, and then we'll move
on. Okay, yeah.
So here he's starting, as he said earlier, there are three components, constituents to perception. And one is the percept, the other is the percipient, and perception itself. And here he takes up the percept, that is the objective universe, and says that, let's take that and say that that is real. Okay, so any of these or all of these could be unreal or real. And so let's assume that the percept alone is real. And so that is the objective universe. And deny or diminish the reality of the percipient individual and his perceptive consciousness. So in other words, he who perceives, the individual, and his power of perception, let's say that those are false. And this is the premise of science, modern science, materialism, what we might call philosophical materialism. In the theory of the sole reality of matter, that's materialism, consciousness is only an operation of matter energy in matter, a secretion of vibration of the brain cells. In other words, consciousness is an accidental epiphenomenon of matter. It arises accidentally in matter. And that kind of a view would certainly also lend itself to this illusionism, that there is no firm basis to our perceptions. We as individuals, the world is true. Here it's the reversal. The world is true, but our perception of the world is false. This is what it becomes. But then he questions the world is true also, and says that this kind of a premise has been investigated by science. And he says, but if matter turns out to be itself unreal or derivative, and simply a phenomenon of energy, energy transforms itself into matter. Matter is a form of energy. As now seems to be the probability, then energy remains as the sole reality. So then we can reduce the material basis into an energetic basis. Say that there is an energy that is becoming this presentation that we call the material world, within which consciousness arises as an epiphenomenon. Remember, the energy basis of matter is not premised as conscious in any way. It is just energetic. And so here he says that the problem there is that this energy is essentially backgrounded by a void. It exists, even if we say it is an eternal existence. There is no being to it, see. So it cannot have permanent status. It can arise and it can disappear. It can just evaporate or, become absent. And that kind of existence could be an abstraction. So he looks at it from both ways. So it may be that the mind is presenting this view, or it may be that within the void it doesn't have any permanent basis. you know, the outbreak of motion which might cease at any time to create phenomena, the void of the infinite alone would then be enduring and real. Okay, so that leaves us with ultimate unreality, you know, kind of a nihilism. Then he takes the Buddhist theory, which says that the percipient and the perception and the percept are all constructions of karma. Now here it becomes a little more tricky, because there are two varieties. One is saying that matter has a reality. That reality, if we don't assume that reality, it's difficult to assume how consciousness takes form in the human being at all. Why is there consciousness? So where from does consciousness come? But then there are other theories that say that there is a primordial consciousness, a kind of a reservoir of consciousness, sort of resting in a void. Okay, he will come to that as well. But basically, this state of whatever arises as consciousness is something which holds true and presents a certain world to us, but that world persists only by power of karma, that there is something in it which causes us to be engaged in it and keep, you know, building a structure that endures only by its own momentum. See? And so that is how they holding this to be a construction of karma, the process of some cosmic fact of action, and that gives this, but that also is grounded in a nihil or a void. Now he posits the fact that that's also to some extent posited by certain forms of Buddhism, that the basis at work in matter is not only just energy, it's transformations of energy, but that it is conscious energy. In other words, there is consciousness backgrounding it. It's possible indeed that what is at work is not an energy but a consciousness. As matter reduces itself to energy seizable by us, not in itself, but in its results and workings, so energy could be reduced to action of consciousness seizable by us, not in itself, but in its results and workings. This is the idea that, you know, Vishishta Advaita holds, which is that we can never really know the divine being in as itself, which is the other. The Advaita holds the fact that we can only know the divine in and as itself, but not in its phenomena. The phenomena are illusory. Vishishta Advaita takes the opposite view. We can only know the divine in its phenomena, not in its in itself. In other words, it is invisible and it is also unknowable, but it makes itself known through its world, through its phenomena. So this is a consciousness not, you know, it's not seizable to us in itself, but in its results and workings. So too, energy could be reduced to an action of consciousness seizable by us, not in itself, but in its results and workings. It's backgrounding everything. But then he presents again, what is backgrounding consciousness? Out of what does it arise? Whose consciousness is it? And he's saying, well, we can say it's just consciousness. There is no background to it, as some schools of Buddhism do, putting it to rest in a nihil. So that, again, is a similar conclusion, that it is a creator of temporary phenomenal illusions and itself illusory. Void and infinite zero and original non-existence is alone the enduring reality. But then he says that why should we believe these things? They are not binding on us. If we want to hold them, we can hold them. But they seem, the plausibility is more as if we are imposing them. It's sort of like Keka said, they seem more to be like abstractions. They seem to be like rationalizations and abstractions. So if we go one step further, for behind this consciousness, seizable in its works only, there may be an invisible original existence. a conscious energy of that existence could then be a reality. So if it is being, whose consciousness is that which has become this material universe, then it is a reality. Its creations too, made out of an infinitesimal substance of being, impalpable to the senses, but revealed to them at a certain stage of the action of energy as matter, would be real. In other words, whatever we call subatomic particles are also forms of consciousness and forms of being. And they would make themselves known to us at a certain point in the evolution of our consciousness. Would be real as also the individual emerging as a conscious being of the original existence in a world of matter. All these things would be real because nothing other than the being whose consciousness has become these things. This original reality might be a cosmic spiritual existence, a pantheos. A cosmic spiritual existence, or pantheos, is sort of like pantheos is a being that can become or take any form that exists in the cosmos. All forms in the cosmos, it's like a kind of like, this is what gives rise to the Puranic ideas of the multi-headed and multi-limbed forms of God. You know, there are also forms of Vishnu that are shown with multi-animal heads. And so this is, the pantheos is the single being that wears all the forms of the universe. Every individual is a name and form of that cosmic being. So that is the original reality might be that, or it might have some other status. As he'll point out, that the cosmic creation and all its possibilities is even itself a binding. You know, there is whatever exists outside that binding and within it. That's why the premise of Shankara is not being negated. The original premise that the Brahman is true as a immutable self, transcendental self, is also true. But it is that same self that has become this universe and is this pantheos. In any case, there would be not a universal illusion or mere phenomenon, but a true universe. So this is how he approaches the first, you know, premise of the percept being true, the percipient and the perceptive consciousness being false, brings him around to this kind of a view by proceeding through analysis of the ground of being, one may say.
So, Devishish, in this paragraph, it seems to me that he's assuming that reality is intelligible, and so he's arguing that if you just have energy, but you don't have any, or you deny that there's anything that it comes from, that makes it unintelligible. Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, in a sense, yes. He's looking at it from the viewpoint of something which is conscious, kind of, see, like he goes over here, it is possible indeed that what is at work is not an energy but a consciousness. So, you know, these are possibilities that he's taking up, and basically he's saying that there is no need to, you know, affirm a certain kind of reality in itself, that there is only, because there it becomes a certain, it ends in a kind of a dead end, you know, it ends in a nihil. So he's saying that is there a way by which we can not end in a nihil, which doesn't give any, neither any meaning to the cosmos, nor any enduring state to the cosmos. While we can see that there is a certain kind of a intuition of permanence to the cosmos, or to at least something behind the cosmos. So that's where he's bringing in consciousness. Yes, it is intelligible, and also it has this kind of sense of something which is not necessarily nihilistic. It's the assumption of the nihil as the ground of things that he is questioning, and going step by step from a purely material existence and the phenomenal nature of consciousness to the fundamental nature of consciousness as a better explanation, and then to the existence of a conscious being who has become all this as a better explanation, or as a non-nihilistic explanation.
So it seems to me that if you settled for a nihilistic explanation,
yeah,
you're saying that the explanation is nothing. I mean, there's no explanation, which would mean it's not really intelligible. There's no way to. I mean, you can say it, but it doesn't.
It's an illusion. It's an illusion. It's an illusion created by an illusion. It's sort of like saying that.
Means there's no intelligibility, because we're left with illusions then.
Yeah.
And what about the juxtaposing this with the Buddhist theory of recipient and the perception and the precept all being construction of karma, the capital K there, and of action? This is, I guess, what Aurobindo is saying here, that there is no consciousness, there is no presupposed consciousness behind karma, as he's reading this Buddhist theory of karma here.
Either that, or he is pointing to the possibility of a consciousness, but no being. So, you know, there are Buddhist schools like the,
right,
you know, Yogacara school, which believes in the ground reality of consciousness. They call it Alaya Vijnana, which is like a universal manas, you know, in which the seeds of karma are sprouting. And, you know, it's like a ground in which the seeds of karma are sprouting and taking the form of our experiences. But that ground is actually hanging in a void. There is nothing behind it.
So it's consciousness, but there's nothing behind that.
There is no being. There's no, whose consciousness is it? Can't be answered. It is not self-conscious of itself as a being. It's a paradox in terms itself, as you can see, that's what the whole difficulty is. I mean, a consciousness without self-consciousness is a paradox in terms.
Yeah, because you also bring into this juxtaposed, I mean, with together with karma, you bring in the ground of being, suchness, the emptiness, and the impermanence of everything, even the impermanence of, which is why I guess they oppose the idea of the Atman, because the Atman would be considered more permanent, but not that you even need to think of it that way. It could even be changing, it could even be evolving, but that's probably another subject. But the point is that what has to be behind this, I mean, this consciousness that there's no, where is the genesis, where is the origin, where is, so I guess Aurobindo is just following this back more.
I didn't catch the last part of your, what you said, Owen.
Well, you said he's pointing out the, did you say contradiction? Is that?
He's pointing out the, yeah, the, there is a contradiction and there is a nihilism behind it. It's a kind of, in
right.
all these cases we are arriving at an illusion that is caused by an illusion. You see, that's the contradiction. He's starting with one of these three, the percept, one of these as real, but then he's probing it to show that that is grounded in an unreality. Ultimately, there is a, what is the ground of all this? If we can't, even if we say there is a consciousness, but there is no being to whom the consciousness belongs or out of which it has come, then there is no ground to it. In other words, you know, there is no intent behind it, you see. And, you know, that's what John Robert called intelligence. There is no, if there is no ground to consciousness, karma is being produced automatically within it, then the whole thing is resting on a void, which is ultimately without any, you know, sort of reality. It's illusion producing illusions.
And I think the more that one takes the experiential view of karma, and the more that one drops in into experiencing and trying to witness and trying to really go deeper and deeper and penetrate deeper into this idea of action, of thoughts and feelings, and I think so much is built upon this. I mean, the whole Wayne Dyer, the whole, I guess, the whole New Thought and Wayne Dyer movement of creating your own reality and that's this type of a thing. All has its basis, I think, in the law of attraction and all of this, I think, has much of its basis in trying to work more deeply with the nature of the universe. And trying to, and so karma is often in the background of so much, but I think that it's seen in such a limited way, and it's not really perceived in a very experiential fashion a lot of times, or at least on a very deep level. And so anyway, I just kind of, you know, pointing out that I think that, the deeper I've gone personally into looking and trying to drop into witness and trying to look at karma. I mean, because if you look at what Bodhidharma says in the Bloodstream Sermon that pretty much all of these things that are happening to us or happening to the individual are the result of karma. And this is entirely at odds with the whole new way of thinking of things now, where one is a victim of multiple circumstances of injustices. And so it's probably a long conversation, but it's you know, it really does come down to the nature of the universe. But I does it intuitively for me, to go back to this specific point, intuitively for me, it's a consciousness without being doesn't make sense. It doesn't resonate without multiple forms of being, or, you know, going back farther, whatnot, into the pantheon, you know, into the pantheon. But, yeah, so intuitively it's never made sense to me that there can just be a consciousness without a being behind it. Because of the, it's just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you see that the theory of karma as Sri Aurobindo sees it, naturally there are at least three chapters in the Life Divine dealing with that. You know, is not as automatic as these people make it out to be. He's saying essentially it's the soul's choice in its own evolution, and it's never a case that we are supposed to accept it. In other words, whatever karma is, and you pointed out, of course, that there's another way of looking at things, is that we are victim of historical circumstances, you know, circumstances of birth, circumstances of environment, and things like that. And that way of looking at things is as good or as bad as looking at it as being subject to karma. In both cases, the soul has to struggle. And the struggle of the soul, either over its own shortcomings, because karma ultimately points to deficiencies in the psyche, or shortcomings of the world, ultimately the two have to be brought together and seen as a condition of action, you know, based on both psychological evolution as well as activism in the world, you know, doing the right thing that is needed. So, again, you know, to look at karma as an automatism which completely binds us is this sort of notion that, you know, you could talk of a consciousness which is, you know, unintentional, and out of it all this karma is arising. You know, and he's questioning that very severely and seriously, because according to him, rebirth and karma, the soul's evolution is what takes precedence, and that has intent to it. That is intending the experiences that we are having, in a sense, so that it may evolve.
Yes, and there seems to be a mercy or a intelligence, a further intelligence, which is supporting that soul's evolution within
Absolutely.
The backdrop of this system.
It's well put.
And that it is not, inflexible and automatic and recognized as
yeah.
such.
Yeah.
Even though there is seems to be law, and there does seem to be principle, there does seem to be a structure, but it's not inflexible.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that consciousness denotes being to me, because it's intentional, as you're saying. It's calibrated. It's subtle, nuanced, and it's directly tailored to the individual in such a way that only infinite intelligence, which I associate with people and with being,
right?
So, yes,
absolutely. There is, you know, the mother says that there is the law of statistics and there is the law of grace. You know, there are two laws, and the both are present at the same time. And individual that, you know, aspires falls into the orbit of the law of grace that can change the inflexible laws of things.
Mm. Beautiful.
Then Buddhism also comes up, you know, Mahayana Buddhism reintroduces the idea of grace through the Bodhisattvas. But still, these are not the supreme being. You know, it's almost as if everybody's ability is only constrained by, you know, by the ground of being. They can give you nirvana. They can help you towards that. They can help you to be released from the conditions of the world, but not to transform the conditions of the world. So you see all these schools, this is one of the reasons why Buddhism is so complex, is because they start with a premise that has to add on its rejects afterwards. And that makes it more and more complex over time. So because it eventually, you know, sort of compensates for its, you know, neglected pieces.
In this regard, where did the transcendentalists? I'm embarrassed to say that I'm not quite sure how. In the end, how does transcendentalism parallel what we're talking about here?
Well, you know, transcendentalism, at least the German variety and also the American variety, sees, you know, it's not a transcendentalism in the Advaita sense, that there is a transcendental to the universe that alone is true, but it is more a panentheism, because it believes that there is a transcendental one being that is present also in nature. So all of nature is that being, and that being is manifesting in all the creatures as well. So except for a more explicit form of evolution, there is an intrinsic or implicit evolutionary component to transcendentalism also, but it's not worked out as well. But the unity of God and nature and their presence in the creatures is what is affirmed by transcendentalism in all creatures.
Yes.
So I think we're past our closing time.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, maybe we can stop with this point and plan to continue in September.
Sure. Yeah, it'll be
the
10th of September, yes.
Yes, so let's stop now, and I'll upload the talk later today, and we can continue on September 10th.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Devashish.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye.